Okay, well, welcome everybody. Today's overall theme is on sutta study, and of course our Upasika days take different themes through the year, and this one is going plugging into the suttas, the discourses of the Buddhas. Having a and then picking up the topic on working with thought in the sense that both understanding thought, but then also how to work with it, how to clear the mind so that it actually does settle sometime. The topic I think is quite useful in the sense that we're all plagued by our thoughts, so and we all believe them, so it's important to have a perspective where one can step back and have a larger framework for how do we hold these thoughts, and how can we frame them so that they can be useful? Because sometimes it's necessary to just sort of let them run their course and realize, okay, I'm not going to make much of a dent in this. And so, but then it's consciously sort of okay. This is how I'm going to hold it. So then you're bringing in a quality of patience and with that awareness. And then, because sometimes you'll also pay attention to, okay, how to relinquish, how to let go, how to release different thought patterns. Because the mind does tend to keep circling around the certain thought patterns, and of course they're not just sort of thoughts that are random. What I'm moving to is they're almost always emotionally charged, so. It's not just some sort of neutral, oh, there's a thought. It's just there's usually an emotion behind there, and that's usually generating and feeding the whole thought process. So just being able to recognize that and work with that. And the first the suttas that we'll be picking up are from the middle-length discourses, the Majjhima Nikaya, and Majjhima 19, which is that'll be the first one, and the second one is Majjhima 20, which is the removal of distracting thoughts. So they're complementary discourses that help to investigate these thought processes. And how we thought to say schedule the day would be to begin with just reading the sutta out loud, because this is an oral tradition, so that they're meant to be listened to as opposed to being read. They're meant to be, meant to be heard. So that the, and that's what sutta actually means, has that meaning of hearing within that. So that I'll read Majjhima 19, we can have a bit of a discussion, and then I'll turn it over to Ajahn Kruna Dhammo, who will read Majjhima 20, and similarly we'll have a discussion, Q&A, with that, and then mid-afternoon, we'll have a bit of a break as is necessary, and and come back for a short meditation, and then break out into small groups for small group discussion. These Upasika days, sometimes they lend themselves to small group discussions, and sometimes it's better to keep it in a big group. But this topic seemed to fit with and it can be fruitful to have small group discussions and bounce ideas off each other rather than being just listening to us. So I'll begin with so this is Majjhima 19. Thus have I heard. On one occasion, the Blessed One was living at Savati in Jeta's Grove, Anathapindika's Park. There he addressed the bhikkhus thus. Bhikkhus, Venerable Sir, they replied. The Blessed One said this. Bhikkhus, before my enlightenment, while I was still only an unenlightened bodhisattva, it occurred to me, suppose that I divide my thoughts into two classes. Then I set on one side thoughts of sensual desire, thoughts of ill will, and thoughts of cruelty. And I set on the other side thoughts of renunciation, thoughts of non-ill will, and thoughts of non-cruelty. As I abided thus, diligent, ardent, and resolute, a thought of sensual desire arose in me. I understood thus. This thought of sensual desire has arisen in me. This leads to my own affliction, to others' affliction, and to the affliction of both. It obstructs wisdom, causes difficulties, and leads away from Nibbana. When I considered, this leads to my own affliction, it subsided in me. When I considered, this leads to others' affliction, it subsided in me. When I considered, this leads to the affliction of both, it subsided in me. When I considered, this obstructs wisdom, causes difficulties, and leads away from Nibbana, it subsided in me. Whenever a thought of sensual desire arose in me, I abandoned it, removed it, did away with it. As I abided thus, diligent, ardent, and resolute, a thought of ill will arose in me. And it goes through the same sequence of dealing with the thought of ill will and the thought of cruelty. And so that, and considering in these different ways, subsided, and the Buddha abandoned those thoughts. Because whatever a bhikkhu frequently thinks and ponders upon, that will become the inclination of his mind. If he frequently thinks and ponders upon thoughts of sensual desire, he has abandoned the thought of renunciation to cultivate the thought of sensual desire. And then his mind inclines to thoughts of sensual desire. If he frequently thinks and ponders upon thoughts of ill will, upon thoughts of cruelty, he has abandoned the thought of non-cruelty to cultivate the thought of cruelty, and then his mind inclines to thoughts of cruelty. Just as in the last month of the rainy season, in the autumn, when the crops thicken, a cowherd would guard his cows by constantly tapping and poking them on this side and that with a stick to check and curb them. Why is that? Because he sees that he could be flogged, imprisoned, fined, or blamed if he let them stray into the crops. So too, I saw in unwholesome states danger, degradation, and defilement, and in wholesome states the blessing of renunciation, the aspect of cleansing. As I abided thus, diligent, ardent, and resolute, a thought of renunciation arose in me. I understood thus. This thought of renunciation has arisen in me. This does not lead to my own affliction, or to others' affliction, or to the affliction of both. It aids wisdom, does not cause difficulties, and leads to Nibbana. If I think and ponder upon this thought, even for a night, even for a day, even for a night and day, I see nothing to fear from it. But with excessive thinking and pondering, I might tire my body. And when the body is tired, the mind becomes strained. When the mind is strained, it is far from concentration. So I steadied my mind internally, quieted it, brought it to singleness, and concentrated it. Why is that? So that my mind should not be strained. As I abided thus, diligent, ardent, and resolute, a thought of non-will arose in me, a thought of, and then it goes on the same sequence, a thought of non-cruelty arose in me, and understanding in that same way as with the thoughts of renunciation. So I steadied my mind internally, quieted it, brought it to singleness, and concentrated it. Why is that? So that my mind should not be strained. Because whatever a bhikkhu frequently thinks and ponders upon, that will become the inclination of his mind. If he frequently thinks and ponders upon thoughts of renunciation, he has abandoned the thought of sensual desire to cultivate the thought of renunciation. And then his mind inclines to thoughts of renunciation. If he frequently thinks and ponders upon thoughts of non-ill will, upon thoughts of non-cruelty, he has abandoned the thought of cruelty to cultivate the thought of non-cruelty, and then his mind inclines to thoughts of non-cruelty. Just as in the last month of the hot season, when all the crops had been brought inside the villages, a cowherd would guard his cows while staying at the root of a tree or out in the open, since he needs only to be mindful that the cows are there. So too, there was need for me only to be mindful that those states were there. Tireless energy was aroused in me, and unremitting mindfulness was established. My body was tranquil and untroubled, my mind concentrated and unified. Quite secluded from sensual pleasures, secluded from unwholesome states, I entered upon and abided in the first jhana. And then this goes through a whole sequence of stock phrases, teachings on the development of the four jhanas, these state, subtle states of stability in meditation, and then the arising of the three true knowledges, which lead to liberation. And since I directly knew, birth is destroyed, the holy life has been lived, what had to be done has been done, there is no more coming to any state of being. This was the third true knowledge attained by me in the last watch of the night. Ignorance was banished, and true knowledge arose. Darkness was banished, and light arose, as happens in one who abides diligent, ardent, and resolute. Suppose, bhikkhus, that in a wooded range there was a great low-lying marsh, near which a large herd of deer lived. Then a man appeared desiring their ruin, harm, and bondage, and he closed off the safe and good path to be travelled joyfully. And he opened up a false path, and he put out a decoy and set up a dummy so that the large herd of deer might later come upon calamity, disaster, and loss. But another man came desiring their good, welfare, and protection, and he reopened the safe and good path that led to their happiness, and he closed off the false path, and he removed the decoy and destroyed the dummy, so that the large herd of deer might later come to growth, increase, and fulfillment. Because I have given this simile in order to convey a meaning. This is the meaning. The great low-lying marsh is a term for sensual pleasures. The large herd of deer is a term for beings. The man desiring their ruin, harm, and bondage is a term for Mara, the evil one. The false path is a term for the wrong eightfold path, that is, wrong view, wrong intention, wrong speech, wrong action, wrong livelihood, wrong effort, wrong mindfulness, and wrong concentration. The decoy is a term for delight and lust. The dummy is a term for ignorance. The man desiring their good welfare and protection is a term for the Tathagata, accomplished and fully enlightened. The safe and good path to be traveled joyfully is a term for the Noble Eightfold Path, that is, right view, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, and right concentration. So, bhikkhus, the safe and good path to be traveled joyfully has been reopened by me. The wrong path has been closed off, the decoy removed, the dummy destroyed. What should be done for his disciples out of compassion by a teacher who seeks their welfare and has compassion for them, that I have done for you, bhikkhus. There are these roots of trees, these empty huts. Meditate, bhikkhus. Do not delay or else you will regret it later. This is our instruction to you. That is what the Blessed One said. The bhikkhus were satisfied and delighted in the Blessed One's words. So when the Buddha says he divided thoughts into two classes, then it's these classes of and also it's interesting to note, of course, that this is the Buddha recollecting his practice while he was still before his enlightenment, before his awakening. So the two classes are the traditional classification from the right intention, the second link of the of intention in the Eightfold Path, so right view, right intention, and the word is sankhapa, and sankhapa has the meaning of both intention, thought, purpose, plan. It has a somewhat broad meaning, and also is an equivalent to the word vitakka, which is a word that is again used like a directed thought. Can be used for directed thought, having these just these putting things on one side and the other, and that also in terms of thoughts of sensual desire. And its opposite is thoughts of renunciation, relinquishment. The word is nekamma. And the opposing ones of, say, in terms of wrong thought, of thoughts of ill will, thoughts of cruelty, and it's written as non-ill will, and on the positive side as non-ill will and non-cruelty. But those are could also be, say, the equivalent of loving kindness and compassion, and I think it's quite skillful to put it, cast it in the. In the negative, in the sense of non-ill will, in that it lays a good foundation for, loving kindness and compassion, but it skirts the tendency to judgment that we often have, because if you say, okay, right thought is thoughts of loving kindness, thoughts of compassion, and then it's very easy to start Oh, that isn't. I don't have enough loving kindness. I don't have enough. Oh, that's not a very good thought of compassion. But you know, so we tend. It's easy to get caught up in judgment or measuring, and which, of course, we tend to measure quite high usually. So that bringing the bar down to, if you can just get caught up in, you know, just ill will and cruelty, just the thoughts of non-ill will, non-cruelty, then that starts to incline in ways that are skillful. So that's a, I think it's an important part of the of the that cultivation of thought and investigation of thought processes, so that we, because as soon as we start measuring and judging, those are thoughts as well, and they'll end up being creating suffering. In the another aspect of looking at, say, two classes, and this in sense of the Buddha putting on, say, wrong thought and right thought, it's in samma sankappa and micha sankappa, but one of the things that comes up in the Buddha's teachings over and over, in terms of ways of investigating the quality of both our mental states or our the results of our practice, is looking in terms of say wholesome, unwholesome, skillful, unskillful, and the Pali word is, say, kusala and akusala, and that has a say akusala, unwholesome, unskillful. They have certain say characteristics or display themselves in certain ways that we can be alert to or investigate. So it can play out and on a, say, a psychological level where it's unhealthy and unhappy. Those are kind of thoughts so in terms of akusala, on a moral level, sort of like morally blameworthy or tainted in some way. Also on a karmic level, in the sense that they're conducive to producing painful results, and so that there's a, when we're looking at, it's a, maybe it's a broader classification of the what the Buddha is suggesting in terms of two classes of thought, and because these are specific to the samma sankappa and micha sankappa, but it's also helpful to be, I think, for investigation, sort of seeing how the Buddha does try to get us to reflect on, in terms of, well, what's the nuances of this wholesome and unwholesome characteristics of things. Kusala has, say, on a psychological level, be leading to kind of like a healthy, happy mind, to morally it would be praiseworthy, untainted, to be associated with goodness, and on a karmic level it's producing pleasant results. It's a another way of looking at it. As we one of the things that struck me as the Buddha is explaining about say, arising of the thought of renunciation, and similarly the thought of non-ill will, non-cruelty, not leading to affliction, doesn't cause difficulties, and then even if I think and ponder upon this for a night or a day, or even a night and a day, I see nothing to fear from it. And because sometimes we try to squelch all thought, and there's some times where okay, it's enough's enough, but still there is a recognition in this teaching that there's a very different result when there are wholesome thoughts, when there are thoughts that are aligned with say sammasankappa, right intention, and to recognize that I see nothing to fear from it, the worst that comes is that it does tire one, and one needs to settle the mind in order to bring the mind to a place of stability and unification. sense of the what the Buddha making this point of whatever a bhikkhu frequently thinks and ponders upon, that will become the inclination of his mind. And so that realizing that we are setting patterns in the mind, whether we like it or not, and so that we're learning how to take responsibility for those thoughts, and putting attention on the process, so that we're not being swept along or swept up in the whole thought process. One of the it's actually the immediately previous sutta in this collection of the middle length discourses, where the Buddha points to how the different thoughts gather momentum. And it's worth just reading it out. It's outside the sutta, but I think it illustrates this process of what one thinks and ponders upon. That's the inclination, and this is using the eye and form as the example, but of course it applies to all of the six senses. The Buddha begins, the dependent on the eye and forms, eye consciousness arises. The meeting of the three is contact. With contact as condition, there is feeling. What one feels, that one perceives. What one perceives, that one thinks about. What one thinks about, that one mentally proliferates. And that's Bhikkhu Bodhi's translation. Ajahn Jeff translates it as objectifies. And I think it's a good a good translation. With what one has mentally proliferated or objectified as the source, perceptions and notions born of objectification or mental proliferation beset one with respect to past, future, and present forms cognizable through the eye. And the same through the ear, the nose, tongue, body, mind. So it's a helpful illustration of how these get on a roll, and we need to be taking a certain amount of interest and responsibility for them. I think also one of the things that's helpful to note that these are the Buddha starts with two kinds of thought, and he's talking about the various ways of thinking, the sutta illustrates these thoughts, but those thoughts, when applied properly, lead to the four jhanas and the three true knowledges, like in the sutta itself. And four jhanas is a having the quite secluded from sensual pleasures, secluded from unwholesome thoughts, abided and entered upon and abided in the first jhana, which is accompanied by applied and sustained thought with rapture and pleasure born of seclusion. So that's it's that directing of the thought processes in a skillful way that allows the mind to settle. The Pali is vitakka and vichara. Ajahn Jeff translates those terms as directed thought and evaluation, which is also a helpful way to illustrate that, along with applied and sustained thought. maybe that's enough input, and if we have any questions or discussion that we want to come up with. Yeah.
The term sense consciousness is used in the morning chanting.
Hmm?
Sense consciousness?
Yes.
I didn't hear that, though. It's almost like it's a step past that in terms of I guess the Buddha's saying he's recognizing the thought and then he's putting it in a certain bin.
Oh, right. That's that in itself is a result of the consciousness of the thought itself. So that then that's a function of awareness of mindfulness to be alert to that movement of thought.
One of my favorite things about the sutta is where he says, before I was awakened, it occurred to me, suppose that I divide my thoughts into two classes. It's like an experiment.
Okay,
let me just see, I love that attitude. Let me try this out.
Yeah.
And see what the outcome is.
Yeah, and that's a great a point to sort of reflect on, because it isn't as if even the Buddha just took some sort of methodology, some kind of technique, and just slapped it down, and it enlightened him. It's more like, it's that taking an interest in exploring. How's this work? What will happen? I wonder what will happen if I do this. How's this going to feel? So that's an important point in terms of how do we make this into a practice, so that internalizing it and exploring. Yeah. Yeah, Neil.
I got a little confused when you were talking about the part where he was saying that these types of thoughts are not to be feared, if that's the right wording.
Yeah, that's with the wholesome thoughts. The thoughts of renunciation, of non-ill will, of non-cruelty, as opposed to the thoughts of sensual desire, ill will, cruelty. These obstruct wisdom. They cause difficulty. Lead away from nibbana. These are problematic. And in the looking at these, recognizing, okay, these don't lead to my affliction or others' affliction or both, and they're, when I do think about it, think them, it's not something to be feared. And I think that's important, because so often in meditation and in practice, we think the goal is to stop all of our thinking, if I didn't, if I didn't think, then I would be peaceful. But in trying to stop thinking, there's incredible tension that's created in the mind. Whereas if one cultivates these wholesome thoughts, the very nature, and like in that list of, say, the kusala and the akusala, part of the, say, the intrinsic psychological nature of a wholesome, of kusala, wholesome thought, is it's happy, it's healthy, and part of happy and healthy is peaceful.
And that was very helpful, thank you, to clarify, because at first my thought was, well, why would I even think these would be harmful?
Yeah.
But, all right, but so now I can, but then you went on to say something, and I wasn't sure if it was from the sutta or your own interpretation. You said something about that those thoughts might make you, and correct me, excuse me if I get the word wrong, it might make you a little tired or something like
yes,
that.
Yes, yes, that's the Buddha. Saying that, he said, I see nothing to fear from it, but with excessive thinking and pondering, I might tire my body. And when the body is tired, the mind becomes strained. And when the mind is strained, it is far from concentration. That's right. Too much of a good thing.
Right. So that feels like it really goes to the four foundations of mindfulness, of knowing when the mind's here. It's like you got first one foundation, know the body, mm-hmm. what's happening to the body.
Yeah, yeah.
It really just feels like it just points right to understanding that.
Yeah, yeah. That's always a helpful doorway to be perceiving experience. Joy. It's in this sutta.
Because sometimes I feel that I'm doing that with my mind. I'm thinking my mind.
Yes, yes.
The other thing that struck me was, which makes it closer to animals as humans too. I thought that was brilliant. Yeah. The way he came out. And the deer, coral also was very.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then he says something about a day and a night. Is
right.
That because sometimes I get very worry is one of my weaknesses, and I just can think of something and
right.
I'm thinking about it and I get really tired and stressed out. And
yeah, well, that would not be.
Is that something that
goes in the other category of unskillful. So it's right off the bat. It's it's not good. Yeah. But so that the and sometimes it's that's when the mind really gets stuck in a track of worry, and that's it's a hindrance, that restlessness and worry, so that the mind gets stuck in that, and it's dukkha in the beginning, dukkha in the middle, and dukkha in the end. Yeah, I mean, that's sort of the thing that's in that illustration of that sense of caution and care of really, okay, let's not let this get really out of control, because it's like, as you said, the cowherd, it's like in the last month of the rainy season, the crops are almost ripe, and you really have to pay attention to where your cows are, because if they get loose into a field, then there's going to be some very unhappy farmers, so it's it's kind of dangerous. So then one needs to be really close at hand, really tapping it here, tapping it there, keeping it away from trouble. And so that's similar with the mind in this sense. Okay, this I see where this is going. I've got to try to poke it and prod it and try to get it into some place that's safe. Yes, Ying.
Question from Tony.
Oh, okay.
He's asking, can you give some advice on using directed and sustained thought? Would these thoughts be like repeating Buddha, or they conceptual?
Yeah, and that's a that's certainly well. There's lots and lots of tools of because those are thoughts, but then they're thoughts that are they have a certain emotional tone, and you want to cultivate that. It's just that recollection of the Buddha, recollection of a meditation object, so that it helps one to stay in, and that's the or so that because vitakka vichara, vitakka is like the way that Ajahn Chah describes it is like the vitakka is like the lifting up into the mind of a thought, and then vichara is the sustaining of that and directing it so that it sustains itself, and so that's a and just lifting up buddho, lifting up the breath, lifting up metta as an object of attention, and then sustaining it. And then of course it falls away, or something else comes in. And you lift it up again and sustain it. And so it's working with that vitakka vichara, lifting with that, working with the whole thought process.
I'm curious about with the wholesome and unwholesome assessment.
Yeah.
If it's a thought of ill will, greed, hatred, delusion, but we're not attached to it, we're just seeing it arise, seeing it pass. Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Like recognizing it, being aware that it's in the mind.
Mm-hmm.
Then does the thought itself? I mean, doesn't the unwholesomeness, or I'm asking you, does the unwholesomeness come from believing it?
Yes, and just the fact that it's there is already is okay. It's got some seeds.
Yeah.
But then it's also recognized that the more one thinks and ponders on a thing, the more it becomes the inclination of the mind. So then realizing that we've got some agency to address it, to either just by bringing, because sometimes just bringing mindfulness, this is an unwholesome thought. Its power dissipates really quickly.
Yeah, and so then with the wholesome thoughts, I mean, they're also inclined in the mind, but only when we, as he describes, ponder upon, spend a lot of time thinking about. I'm reminded of all of the hours I've spent in retreat thinking it was okay to think because I'm thinking about the Dhamma.
right.
Like what this means, what I'm saying, you know, like, it, but it's got stress in it. It's definitely, when I'm lost in it, it's got, it's unwholesome.
Yeah, and there's a, and that's where that, like, reflecting from the point of the five hindrances is helpful in terms of, because something can be ostensibly a good thought, but it has an edge of restlessness to it. Mm-hmm. Or it has an edge of that kind of skeptical doubt to it. And it's not that it's bad. And that's important to recognize. Like, something can be akusala, but it's not as if it's bad. It's just that it clouds awareness and kind of obstructs the path. So same as sleepiness. It isn't as if it's morally reprehensible to be sleepy, but it does obstruct our meditation. Yes, Kurush.
How much should we be using that tool of the two categories? Always? As much as
it works and is helpful. You know, that's where just as in the sutta, the Buddha says, it occurred to me, suppose I do this. So it's like, it's sort of similar. Oh, maybe I'll try this and see what happens. So it's a skillful tool which one can apply and then see how it works. There's lots of tools that the Buddha gave. And we'll get into a whole bunch in the next sutta. Yeah, John.
He doesn't talk about in this teaching about kind of any middle ground, like kind of a neutral, kind of great thought. It's hard for me to describe.
Right.
But thinking that doesn't seem to carry any kind of isn't freighted.
Well, I think that's that. Yeah. Well, I think that's where it just is keeping it simple, you know, as a technique, so that there's because you can develop nuance later.
Yeah.
But it's sometimes helpful to get the broad brush bit down first, and then sort of see, okay, how can I refine this? And of course, that's where it takes one in, say, like, as the sutta goes. I mean, once you start refining it, the refinement is in the, say, in the four jhanas and the three true knowledges. Yeah, Manjay.
So he says, suppose I think this way unwholesome leads to painful results, so I see that and let it go, and let it go. But he doesn't talk about attachment. He doesn't have any attachments. Where does that, is that attachment also thought or also?
Well, it would be. This is a fairly straightforward sutta. So he's not. I mean, that's where the Buddha's teachings. You start gaining a certain body of knowledge and understanding of where the. the applicability of different teachings at different times. One can extrapolate from that and sort of say, okay, there's an attachment when it comes to thoughts of sensual desire, of anger, of ill will or of cruelty. Okay, there's attachment behind it. There's desire behind it. There's clinging. So, but then Buddha isn't addressing that. All he's addressing is, here's these. Why don't I just put these side by side and see what I can do with that? So he's not going. He's not going into extensive analyses. This is broad brush, so it's
So there's a craving there.
Oh yeah.
Essential desire.
Absolutely.
Anything that comes into a perception.
Yeah. Okay, Neil, one last question, and we'll get on to the second sutta.
Do you know what the Pali word is that was being used for sensual desire? Because that raises an interesting question for me. I think craving and sensual desire are kind of different.
It is. This is kama. So it's kama, but it's a K long A M A. So that's a thoughts in terms of kama vitaka, kama sankapa. So that's and it's more specifically sensual desire. Say like craving can be it can display itself as sensual desire, but it's a bit more. It's a broader appellation of mental experience. Okay, I'd like to go on to Machima 20 and have Ajahn Khrun Dhammo go ahead and read from that. Oh, you want to use this?
That's for questions.
Well, I get to set up to stand for 30 seconds or something. You've been sitting for an hour. Just change your position for a moment. So this is still on, or people hear me okay?
Looks like the battery is not green. Red light.
Hmm? Oh, wow. Full battery. The battery was too bad.
grand. How's that? People hear me okay with this now? A little bit louder? How's testing? 1, 2, 3? Maybe I need to adjust this a little bit. Good enough? Okay, I just need to get a little bit closer. Okay. So the second sutta that was on the reading list and read it out here now follows the one that Lungpa just read out and discussed. This one is sutta number 20 in the Majjhima Nikaya, the Vitakka Santana Sutta, or the removal of distracting thoughts. Thus have I heard. On one occasion, the Blessed One was living at Sawati in Jeta's Grove, Anathapindika's Park. There he addressed the bhikkhus thus, "Bhikkhus, Venerable Sir," they replied. The Blessed One said this, "Bhikkhus, when a bhikkhu is pursuing the higher mind, from time to time he should give attention to 5 signs. What are the 5? And the 5 signs are referring to these 5 techniques that he then talks about of dealing with distracting thoughts. Here, bhikkhus, when a bhikkhu is giving attention to some sign, and owing to that sign there arise in him evil, unwholesome thoughts connected with desire, with hate, and with delusion, then he should give attention to some other sign connected with what is wholesome. When he gives attention to some other sign connected with what is wholesome, then any evil, unwholesome thoughts connected with desire, with hate, and with delusion are abandoned in him and subside. With the abandoning of them, his mind becomes steadied internally, quieted, brought to singleness and concentrated. Just as a skilled carpenter or his apprentice might knock out, remove, and extract a coarse peg by means of a fine one, so too, when a bhikkhu gives attention to some other sign connected with what is wholesome, his mind becomes steadied internally, quieted, brought to singleness and concentrated. And just a quick note, the use of the word sign might be a little bit confusing. It's the word nimitta, and translated often as sign. And his footnote mentions that these 5 signs, nimitta, may be understood as practical methods of removing the distracted thoughts, the distracting thoughts. So that was the first method. And the second method, if, while he is giving attention to some other sign connected with what is wholesome, there still arises in him evil, unwholesome thoughts connected with desire, with hate, and with delusion, then he should examine the danger in those thoughts thus. These thoughts are unwholesome. They are reprehensible. They result in suffering. When he examines the danger in those thoughts, then any evil, unwholesome thoughts connected with desire, with hate, and with delusion are abandoned in him and subside. With the abandoning of them, his mind becomes steadied internally, quieted, brought to singleness, and concentrated. Just as a man or a woman, young, youthful, and fond of ornaments, would be horrified, humiliated, and disgusted if the carcass of a snake or a dog or a human being were hung around his or her neck, so too, when a bhikkhu examines the danger in those thoughts, his mind becomes steadied internally, quieted, brought to singleness, and concentrated. Third one. If, while he is examining the danger in those thoughts, there still arise in him evil, unwholesome thoughts connected with desire, with hate, and with delusion, then he should try to forget those thoughts and should not give attention to them. When he tries to forget those thoughts and does not give attention to them, then any evil, unwholesome thoughts connected with desire, hate, delusion are abandoned in him and subside. With the abandoning of them, his mind becomes steadied internally, quieted, brought to singleness, and concentrated. Just as a man with good eyes who did not want to see forms that had come within range of sight would either shut his eyes or look away, so too, when a bhikkhu tries to forget those thoughts and does not give attention to them, his mind becomes steadied internally, quieted, brought to singleness, and concentrated. Number four, if while he is trying to forget those thoughts and is not giving attention to them, there still arise in him evil, unwholesome thoughts connected with desire, with hate, and with delusion, then he should give attention to stilling the thought formation of those thoughts. When he gives attention to stilling the thought formation of those thoughts, then any evil, unwholesome thoughts connected with desire, with hate, and with delusion are abandoned in him and subside. With the abandoning of them, his mind becomes steadied internally, quieted, brought to singleness, and concentrated. Just as a man walking fast might consider, why am I walking fast? What if I walk slowly? And he would walk slowly. Then he might consider, why am I walking slowly? What if I stand? And he would stand. Then he might consider, why am I standing? What if I sit? And he would sit. Then he might consider, why am I sitting? What if I lie down? And he would lie down. By doing so, he would substitute for each grosser posture one that was subtler. So too, when a bhikkhu gives attention to stilling the thought formation of those thoughts, his mind becomes steadied internally, quieted, brought to singleness, and concentrated. And five, if while he is giving attention to stilling the thought formation of those thoughts, there still arise in him evil, unwholesome thoughts connected with desire, with hate, and with delusion, then, with his teeth clenched and his tongue pressed against the roof of his mouth, he should beat down, constrain, and crush mind with mind. Then, with his teeth clenched and his tongue pressed against the roof of his mouth, he beats down, constrains, and crushes mind with mind. Then, any evil, unwholesome thoughts connected with desire, with hate, and with delusion are abandoned in him and subside. With the abandoning of them, his mind becomes steadied internally, quieted, brought to singleness, and concentrated. Just as a strong man might seize a weaker man by the head or shoulders and beat him down, constrain him, and crush him, so too, when with his teeth clenched and his tongue pressed against the roof of his mouth, a bhikkhu beats down, constrains, and crushes mind with mind. His mind becomes steadied internally, quieted, brought to singleness, and concentrated. Bhikkhus, when a bhikkhu is giving attention to some sign, and owing to that sign there arise in him evil, unwholesome thoughts connected with desire, with hate, and with delusion, then when he gives attention to some other sign connected with what is wholesome, any such evil, unwholesome thoughts are abandoned in him and subside. And with the abandoning of them, his mind becomes steadied internally, quieted, brought to singleness, and concentrated. And then through the other four, when he examines the danger in those thoughts, when he tries to forget those thoughts and does not give attention to them, when he gives attention to stilling the thought formation of those thoughts, when with his teeth clenched and his tongue pressed against the roof of his mouth, he beats down, constrains, and crushes mind with mind, then any such evil, unwholesome thoughts are abandoned in him, and his mind becomes steadied internally, quieted, brought to singleness, and concentrated. This bhikkhu is then called a master of the courses of thought. He will think whatever thought he wishes to think, and he will not think any thought that he does not wish to think. He has severed craving, flung off the fetters, and with the complete penetration of conceit, he has made an end of suffering. This is what the Blessed One said. The bhikkhus were satisfied and delighted in the Blessed One's words. So some very very practical suggestions of working with these proliferative, unwanted thoughts. And maybe I'll just make a few comments, and then Lumpa has some to add. We can do that and then have some time for discussion as well. So the first technique is somehow what I classify or refer to myself as thought substitution, so that if you've got an unskillful thought or a distracting thought, usually it's based in some sort of unwholesome mind state, as Lung Paul was mentioning, that tends to proliferate, build on it, on itself, the more attention you pay to it, and the more you get involved with it. So you have to have an antidote, something to, as the simile goes, knock the coarse peg out with a finer peg. And it's pretty classic in terms of what one might want to consider, so that if there's a, say, a thought, a disturbing, proliferative thought of sensual desire that doesn't go away with pure awareness or mindfulness, attention to it, then substituting some counter thought to neutralize it in a way, so that if it's a very strong thought of sensuality, sensual desire, then picking up something like the theme of unattractiveness, looking at the help balance it out, look at the unattractive features of whatever it is that you're only honing in onto the parts that are conducive to bringing up sensual desire. That's what our tendency is, to only see the beautiful in something that that is generally attractive and ignore everything else. So if that's overwhelming your mind, which it can easily do, then you need to shift your focus to just help balance it out, not to engender a sense of revulsion in the strong sense of that word, but as a way of helping to see the reality of the situation, that there's attractive and unattractive all wrapped up in the same package, and it's our desire mind that only sees what it wants to see. So this is a way of helping to counterbalance that tendency. Conversely, if it's a thought that's obsessed with ill will or aversion, then to counter that, if it works, with a thought, say, of loving kindness or compassion, as a way of diverting one's attention or seeing, seeing things like that are repulsive or hard to bear, just in their elemental form, as a way of neutralizing it. Seeing earth, air, fire, wind in its elemental form, if one's mind is caught up in it in some way. So each of these kind of negative mind states, I won't go into all of them, has a counterbalance that one can bring up as a way of establishing equanimity. So if that doesn't work, and the mind doesn't kind of start to settle down, then another option, the second option, is to examine the danger in those thoughts. And to actually bring up the reflection, as he did in the sutta that Lung Pa read, to bring up that thought. Boy, these thoughts are unwholesome, they result in suffering. And to see that process happen, to feel that and to notice the actual result of dwelling in those thoughts. And perhaps that would be sufficient enough to drop it once you've really seen the dukkha, the first noble truth in that particular stream of thoughts. Oh, this is not good. This is not bringing me to a pleasant state of mind. So if that reflection doesn't seem to do the trick, then he should try to just forget these, not turn away from them, not give attention to them, and see if just redirecting one's attention away from that particular thought, kind of moving into more of a forceful kind of way of doing it, but not quite as the last one, not quite as forceful as the last one, but just seeing if one can turns one attention away from it. And if that doesn't work, then the fourth suggestion is a curious one that sometimes I think can be a bit confusing, translated as giving attention to stilling the thought formation of those thoughts. And there's a footnote in the text that probably those of you who read it took a look at, and Bhikkhu Bodhi is quoting from the commentaries and their interpretation of what that might mean. And their take on it, as presented in the commentary, is to kind of using a conceptual process, a questioning process, an investigation, a mental investigation, to take a look and see what the thought was that was preceding that thought, Okay, so before I was thinking this thought and getting lost in it, what was it that was coming up in my mind as a predecessor to that? And then recognizing that and then going back even a further step. Okay, what was happening before that? What was happening before that? In a sequential kind of a way of working backwards to see how you got there in the first place. And the idea is that you do that, you start doing that, and eventually you just either get to the root of it or you just get tired of it and it drops. myself, I've never had a great amount of luck with that particular approach just because, you know, I often find that that kind of conceptual retracing oftentimes just increases the proliferation, and I can get lost in my own backtracking. And one way I heard, a sort of an alternative maybe way of addressing that, and it kind of fits in a little more, I think, too, with the simile of slowing down, because it's not just recognizing the train of thought, but it's also stilling it, letting it calm down, tranquilize in a progressive sequence. And for me, the interpretation that made some sense was taking it back, yes, but taking it back to kind of a lower or a more subtle level in the mind, knowing that the thinking process, the actual words, the ideas, the concepts are kind of on the top layer, and that underneath that are sort of feelings and perceptions. And as Longpaul was saying earlier, there's this, you know, thoughts aren't just the words. There's also usually, particularly these distracting thoughts, there's an underlying emotional state that's supporting them and feeding them, nourishing them. So to try and bring awareness more to that underlying actual feeling state or emotional state or the perception that's kind of backing it up and causing oneself to get lost in it. Because if you can bring it back to that level, say, of feeling, and I think particularly in the body is where you can really know what that feeling is all about, whether it's really pleasant or unpleasant. And to kind of tune into the energy of that thinking, that proliferative thinking. Is it, you know, like kind of a negativity kind of emotion, or is it, a lustful kind of emotion? What's the state of mind? So one step down from the actual words, trying to just set aside the words, go to the feeling, and particularly the feeling in the body. Then that kind of brings you down to a more subtle level. Oftentimes, if we can kind of just not suppress or repress the conceptual part, but set it aside a little bit to really move into the energy in the body, the feeling, and then to consciously help still that and calm that. Oftentimes, I think, best through the breathing itself, so that you use the breath energy to work with that feeling in the body to help cleanse it, settle it, still it. And let it settle down. So you're moving back a layer in the mind or deeper in the mind to something that's a bit more subtle. So that's the way I've found that that particular approach really works, and even not as the fourth approach, but sometimes as the first approach, I find that very useful. But anyway, going on with the sutta, if that doesn't work, then, you know, when you're really caught in this maelstrom of obsessive thinking, then perhaps it's time to, and this is kind of the last resort thing, but to really take a firm stance and to say, no, it's like, forget it, stop it, go away. You have to really, if, you know, it's like tough love, maybe. If I think Ajahn Amaro would use the condition of if there's a child running into the street in front of a truck, you don't kind of say, oh, you know, come here, don't watch out, be careful. You run out to the street, you grab it, and you yank them out of the way. So that's kind of what this approach is, when things are getting dangerous and you can't control it and you're about to do something really stupid, then, you know, pull out all the stops and just be done with it. So I'll just leave it there for a few comments, get any questions going if there are some thoughts or questions.
The last option I thought was really interesting because it's rare that I hear such aggressive terms used. There's almost a sense of violence in some of those terms. So I'm really surprised to see that. Is that just because of the interpretation? And just another spin on that. If you can't get rid of the thought, is another option to just get up and actively do something, walk, physically, you know, with a physicality to kind of get the thought process changed?
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things with the language that the Buddha uses can be in some places, you know, very in your face. You got to deal with it. And part of it is his own background. He's brought up in the warrior caste, so you know he didn't. I don't think they, you know, was doing a whole lot of. He probably got a rounded education, but certainly as a warrior and as a prince, and a lot of it was around martial themes. Yeah, so certainly that's an aspect of his of his background, and I think also just the reality of you know, you think in the same way of the example that Ajahn Khrundamu gave of dealing with a child in a situation where it's very dangerous. I mean, sometimes you don't go to the softest method first, house training a little puppy or something. You know, it's good to try to really encourage it to not crap all over the place, but sometimes, you know, it needs something else, and similarly, our mind has that. So you have to be ready to deal with it where it is, and if where it is really recalcitrant, then you know you leave. It's an option. You see that it's the last one. It's really a last ditch effort, and then your second part of the question around with thought, and you know, because sometimes, yeah, sitting in meditation, the mind just it's just going round and round and round, and sometimes that's where it's, you know, you acknowledge, okay, my mind is obsessed, I'm getting totally swept up in this, but whatever I've tried isn't working. Oftentimes one of the things I encourage the monks to do is go pick up a broom and go sweep the paths, do something physical that you can take some kind of pleasure in. Go and clean up the dying shed, or clean up the meditation hall, clean up the shrine. Do that with your kuti, just giving your shrine a really good cleaning. It really brightens and changes the mind, so that it isn't always the case that one, you know, follow, you know, again, you just to say, okay, what works, and sometimes, yeah, more meditation is you know, more obsession. it's helpful to kind of deflect it, and you're doing it with mindfulness. It's not just sort of out of boredom or sort of as, oh, okay, I've tried this, I've tried that, this isn't working. Okay, and I should really do something a bit more physical. And that oftentimes dissipates the power of it, and you can come back to it.
Just to add a little bit, that's okay, I'll talk loud. I remember once talking about this sutta, somebody had a real severe objection to that last one, you know, thinking, oh, that really sounds violent, you know, a strong man taking a weak man and crushing, you know, and that kind of stuff. I don't like that. And it's not that the, I just wanted to emphasize, it's not that the Buddha is advocating, you know, people crushing other people. It's just a simile in terms of how sometimes that strength of mind is needed. You know, it's not meant to be violent, but taking strong measures is what he is pointing to.
Is that strong measure of crushing the man, is that considered getting up and sweeping? That's kind of the stronger take in dealing with something that you can't...
That's a stronger, you know, in the sense of... in this particular technique, I mean, you're sitting there really using a forceful application of settling the mind. And sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. And if it doesn't, and that's your last ditch effort, then you have to come up with something else. Then that's part of practice, taking an interest in seeing what works.
But sometimes it can happen. I find, you know, you can't use that on just a purely mental level before you get up and do the sweeping. You know,
yeah.
If you see something coming up and it's just going on and on and on, just to kind of clear the screen with just saying, you know, mentally saying, no, stop that. You know, this is not going anywhere. It's kind of like
reset.
Yeah, reset.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think there was in one of the readings, I think, by Ajahn Amaro, he talked about a teacher, I don't know if it was Ajahn Amaro, or somebody who was an ex-boxer.
Yes.
And he was rather, I guess, rough-hewn in his manners and stuff, and someone took offense at that. And he said, well, I'm rough. I used to be a boxer.
Right. You know,
violence get up, I knock them down.
A lot of it's with the temperament of the Ajahn. So
yeah.
And it was actually particularly like Ajahn Mahabua was criticized by Ajahn Mun for just saying, you know, you need to develop some subtlety. it's just going, you know, just going in there and slugging away in the middle of the ring. It's just, you know, it's not a good long-term strategy.
But sometimes.
Yeah. Yes, David.
Just out of curiosity, you know, after, I think, a long time in practice of trying to order thoughts around, you go here and you go there.
Yeah.
Not necessarily being so fruitful. There's been sort of more an experiment with just trying to observe, and even when thoughts are really spinning and proliferating, and it can be quite unpleasant, just trying to bring a certain kind of awareness and let them spin. And sometimes, of course, there's getting lost in them. Sometimes also, there's also quite a strong sense of just being present with that.
Yeah.
I was curious sort of where that fits in. If there is a strong sense of watching,
Well, it could fit into that fourth method of the stilling the thought formation of those thoughts. So it's just that very awareness is already stilling that kind of the impetus of those thought formations, that building and compiling, compounding. So that just that applying mindfulness and attention has the ability to settle. Yeah, Gurush.
I think it was either the third or fourth that you read to us or gave us an example. When you said to kind of go into your body to feel that underlying emotion from that actual thought that's coming, what if when you get to that emotion or bodily feeling that it's so uncomfortable and you're like, really like, oh wow, I really don't want to feel in that way.
Yep.
How do you deal with it in that manner? Because I like that, you know, way of dealing with it, but I kind of see a little bit of a scary part to it.
Yeah, sometimes. Yeah, no, it's you go to, can go to some scary places, and that's where, say, outside of, like, these are very direct ways of dealing with thoughts and in meditation, and but there's other ways. There's, of course, there's so many ways of dealing with it. So that one of them is just the, as I talked about when for the group that was here before the meal, of taking the refuges and precepts, just the benefit and the power of that recollection of refuges and precepts, recollection of say Buddha as a object of devotion and confidence, faith. Same with the Dhamma, but that can get discursive. But Sangha as well, in terms of recollection of those who have tread the path before, who've practiced well, who are good examples, so that then it gives giving confidence. So the directing attention to objects of mind which give confidence. So there's that element of devotion or faith is an important thing, or the just the importance of virtue and the recollecting the good things that one has done. And rather than getting obsessed with thoughts of that are getting pulled into some kind of either desire or aversion, and so those are just examples of ways of directing attention other than, you know, say these particular methods. I mean, there's lots to choose from.
Just to add a little bit to that, I find that using the technique that Wimpaw was just mentioning of bringing up something that's really settling or peaceful or reassuring as a refuge, in conjunction with kind of going into the body and touching, you know, getting, it's not touching, but getting close to the spot where it feels really uncomfortable, where you don't want to go to because you're kind of fearful of what you might open up, you know, the pain, the difficulty, but to kind of be with it, just at least on the side or tangentially, and then move back to the consideration or the reflection that is reassuring, and then, you know, stabilize the mind a little bit with that peaceful thought, and then kind of go and touch that spot in the body a little bit closer, kind of, but not push it too hard so that you're just creating a sense of resistance and got to get out of here, escape, kind of moving back and forth between those two places.
Okay. It seems kind of, I don't know, really difficult to think of like something Dhamma or refuges while in such a wrapped up.
Mm-hmm.
I just feel like it's kind of like, I don't know if I could even do that.
Mm-hmm. Right.
It's pretty hard.
Well, sometimes it's just reflecting on the like dukkha. This is dukkha.
That's probably easier.
No, so like really sort of really kind of naming it clearly, sort of like, this is dukkha, but then also being willing to look at it from, you know, you don't have to sort of go in and try to figure it, but you know, like, oh, this is dukkha. This is exactly what the Buddha is saying. Okay, can, and then you're bringing up images in the mind of you know, that sort of caring or looking after, that quality of compassion and loving kindness for a being who's in dukkha. Yeah, joy.
There's an underlying faith that we can change, and the more I'm in this path, and I love this sutta because I think it's very proactive and it gives me things to do. I'm more of a doer than a being. But what I've discovered also in this path is that, we can change. And sometimes I feel at the same time that we cannot change, and it's just accepting ourselves better and being better in our bodies or more at ease in our bodies.
Yeah.
Or lower our expectations more and more each time.
That's change.
That's change. Okay.
That's change. That's change in itself.
So I'm struggling with a little bit with personal faith or developing my personal faith. Trust in my body and not hurt myself and accept myself.
It's really important because that's one of the, when the Buddha speaks of spiritual faculties, the very first one is faith. We have a problem with faith in the English language. But it's much more, say, this quality of confidence, a sense of having confidence, a certain where the mind is kind of steadfast in its trust. So those are qualities which are important, necessary to be cultivated. Yeah, Manjari.
I remember one time I was really to the edge of all kinds of, upsetness and all that. And my mind, I think, automatically came up with calling upon the three refuges in a way that seemed very useful for me. So when I'm there, I say, when I'm deluded and down, may the Buddha be my light. Mm-hmm. May the Dharma be my guide, may the Sangha be my friend. I keep saying that.
Mm-hmm.
When delusion and darkness fills my body and my mind, may the Buddha be my light, may the Dharma be my guide, may the Sangha be my friend.
Yeah.
And I keep saying it, and it really calms me down.
Yeah. And that's where sometimes, like, the discursive, using a discursive application of mind. This is a skillful use of thought. I say learning to use the thought processes in a skillful way, so bringing to mind the things that do help to encourage and stabilize us in the practice.
And putting a lot of intention, determination that this is dukkha.
Yeah. I need out of this dukkha. Yeah. Yeah, Sonia.
I found all these techniques have been useful to calm the thoughts in the moment.
Yeah.
And but with ill will and forgiveness, I found that it hasn't genuinely changed the underlying emotion. Because 3 months, 6 months down the road, when I thought I had forgiven somebody, and ill will comes up towards that same person, it's like, well, that one bad.
Right.
When does that? You genuinely change the underlying emotion versus just calming the thoughts and the meditation?
Well, again, I think it comes back to what one thinks and ponders upon that becomes the inclination of the mind. And also, in that sense, just as you talked about it or described it, one of the things you didn't take note of is that you didn't think about it for 3 or 6 months. and that's something, yeah. you have to sort of see your successes as well as your failures. So it's like this, and the thing is when you've get a handle on it and it subsides, even when it comes back, it doesn't have that same sting or the same compulsion, because it has been set down, and one hasn't bought into it. And there might still be some power there, and you know, some things are really do take a lot of time. But it's that seeing it, being willing to acknowledge it and recognize it, and then bring attention to bear on it in a skillful way. Neil.
I'm not sure why, but when the word evil comes up in a Buddhist context, it always takes me by surprise.
Yes, yes.
What is the word being translated when
Bapa.
It says evil thoughts?
Bapa. Bapa. So it's like it's a strong word in the Pali, stronger than, say, akusala. It has unfortunate connotations in the English language, but it is stronger than sort of, you know, just the word bad. Bad is kind of so. It's almost as unrecognizable for what it is as good. I mean, good can be, you know, this tastes good or that looks good. It doesn't really have much of a sting behind it on a moral sense. But then, evil is, it definitely gets attention. I think it's a bit too strong and has too many connotations. The Pali word is papa. And,
so maybe like morally unfortunate.
Yeah, which is... that's really morally unfortunate. But I think over time, I think the like in the Thai language, that's not translated. It's left. Like there's many words in the Thai language are just left in the Pali or Sanskrit because. And then you gather their own connotations around them. So that's, you know, which is starting to happen in the English language. There's like karma, dharma, different things that are starting to have into regular usage.
Sometimes incorrect.
This is true too, yes. Well, the same thing happens in Thai, actually. I mean, there are some words in Thai that are directly from the Pali, but they have a different meaning than the Pali. So you do have to distinguish them. It's over time. That's the nature of language. It shifts so much sometimes. Yeah.
Question from Tony. He asked, Lumpur, how can you connect the five methods with the development of insight, which people tend to equate with just observing? Connecting that with the development of insight.
Or development of insight. Well, I think one of the things is the use of these five methods is a way of helping to settle the mind. And then once one has settle the mind or to a certain degree, then one uses that settled mind to start to investigate anicca, dukkha, anatta, impermanence, unsatisfactory, not-self, investigate just the causal processes of, say, like dependent origination. So then that's a seed for insight, but that... But the mind does need to be a bit settled for there to be an insight arising. Help is necessary; it's essential. So these five methods are laying a bit of a foundation for the mind to actually be settled.
And one way of doing that too is to just. When the mind does let go of the unwholesome or the train of thought that's been obsessing you, is when it has settled down to investigate. Well, where did that go? You know, what was that all about? I invested so much energy and concern around that at the time and was really involved with it, but now it's gone. You know, and noticing that it actually ceased. It went away, and it's not there now.
Yeah, right.
Isn't that where you're building faith?
Yeah.
When you went to me, when I watch this stuff, it's like, oh, it moves, and it even feels different in my body. That, to me, is how part of my sense of building faith in the practice is because I'm watching these energies that they actually do come and go. Mm-hmm. And if I'm perceiving them neither as good, bad, right, or wrong, as just energies, mm-hmm. comfort or discomfort, then I actually begin to watch a move. Is it pleasant or unpleasant and becoming neutral? Which kind of takes me back a little bit when you were talking about the other question and coming back to your body. It's energy, again, the discomfort. And if I'm not putting it in the category of right or wrong, I can actually move into it even a little more. And through that investigation, I actually find out more about it. You know, and I often find a lot of times it's just unresolved grievings or things that we've never wanted to deal with or feel in our life. And we're just allowing ourselves to kind of get to it. And instead of pushing it away and thinking it's wrong, it's like we need to open up to our humanness. And that, to me, comes back to the faith. Is like, oh, I can go there and it will. Because I'm learning that it's okay. Just because it's discomforting doesn't mean it's leading me sometimes towards something, like you were saying, that I need to stop avoiding.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that was one thought. And then I have another question. It goes back to number five. It's the language that's used. It just catches me. Because when, you know, and I hear what we're saying, but the way he explained it, mind against mind. And so if I'm pushing against, I don't want, to me, and you can help me, here's this thought mind of thought. I don't want it, and I'm pushing against it. Well, if I'm pushing against the thought, and I'm beating it down, and using my tongue and all the energy in my body, I'm actually more attached to it because of that. And so it's never made sense to me the way it's written, because to me I see it as more attached to.
Yeah, and so much of what we resist strenuously usually gives it more power.
Yeah. Persists.
Yeah, so that... And yeah, the Buddha was obviously more skillful than us. So, but you know, I think that it's important to take note of even if it doesn't really work for us, it is an option that the Buddha mentioned, even if it is last. It's probably. Probably not to be discounted, but it's also you have to pay attention to, well, what actually works for me.
Yeah.
And that technique has never really worked for me.
So. But realizing that it's not the first line of approach, you know, and that it's only when that particular train of thought is going to be so overwhelming that it's going to really cause you to do something, body, speech, or mind, that's a lot worse than what you would do if you were to really just push it away. I mean, this is like extreme examples, you know.
Yeah,
if you're caught in a thought that's leading you close to murdering somebody, as a very strong example, then it's better to crush your mind.
Crush your teeth and don't go murder somebody. One other thought, I actually tried the method that you were saying, go back and check it. It was actually Ajahn Amaro that got me to start working with that method, and it was amazing. Sometimes when I just take the thought and I go back, and it came from a color or a flower or a bush or an object that I saw, and I saw, oh, I connected to this color, had this thought, went to that thought, and then all of a sudden I'm in an argument with somebody in my head. Just from a little, it was amazing me how many times it actually comes from nothing.
Yep. Neil.
I want to take the side of the fifth one.
Yes.
Say,
Good for you.
It starts to sound violent when you read it, but then when he says mind, use mind on mind, and then I'm like, oh, it's not. He's not saying use your body. He's not saying use your fists or anything like that. And so to me, it's just like saying, you know, there isn't any attachment to it at all. It's just, you know, stop. You know, or just thought over thought. It's actually kind of subtle. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there's always different ways of reading and reading in. It's often helpful to hear these different perspectives. Yeah.
Well, this is a question from Bonnie.
Yep.
Her friend is having anxiety about her pregnancy issues during her practice. These are understandable but not helpful for her well-being. Mm-hmm. Do you have any recommendations for dealing with legitimate fears?
Well, I mean, one is really recognize them, because there's lots you can be afraid of, but I think one of the things that's really helpful is to start visualizing, especially like with pregnancy, really start visualizing the being that one's bringing into the world, and really taking time to generate loving kindness and compassion. Really making it look very tangible, because it's one is for oneself, of course, but also for this sort of new being that's coming into the world and really surrounding it with a sense of loving kindness and compassion. Once you go down the track of all the things that could go wrong and you could be fearful of, there's no end to it. But really countering it with a very conscious application of metta and karuna. And it's just really setting one's hopes or aspirations and care and concern.
Would that go under a category of maybe a smaller pig?
That's a good, yeah. That's a good category to put it in, yeah. Yeah.
My own experience with the number five has been, it works when what's doing the mind that's crushing is compassion mind, wisdom mind, you know, out of compassion for myself, rather than I hate this thought and the feelings associated with it, I need to get rid of it, rather than aversion.
Yeah.
And that's a really long, to be able to discern the underlying intention
but the result is very, very different.
Very different. You get so much subtler.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, it's like the example of the mother running out into the street to pull the kid.
It's very firm, very powerful.
Tough love.
Yeah, but soft at the same time, you know.
Yeah. Okay, let's have a break. Stretch your legs, use the washroom, use the facilities, come back at about 5 after 3, just after 10, about 15 minutes. Okay, we can take this opportunity to sit quietly, having a period of meditation. Using this theme of thought and thinking, and there's been many different techniques, methods, as well as perspectives that have been brought up in the last couple hours, and all useful for both contemplation as well as for application. They're just taking the opportunity to apply something, experiment with it, but taking the opportunity to establish awareness and attention. I think it's always helpful to bring the attention, focus of mindfulness back to the body, to the breath. Just this solid, steady anchor for the mind to develop its continuity of attention, continuity of awareness. Today is a sutta study day, so I thought for the meditation, just to seed the meditation with a short sutta from from the Itivuttaka. It's a part of the short verses. And particularly directing attention to skillful thought. So there are these three kinds of skillful thinking that produce non-blindness, produce vision, produce knowledge, foster discernment, side with non-vexation, and are conducive to Nibbana. Which three? Thinking imbued with renunciation, thinking imbued with non-ill will, thinking imbued with non-harming. Three skillful thoughts should be thought. Three unskillful thoughts rejected. Whoever stills sustained thoughts as rain would a cloud of dust. Through an awareness with thinking stilled, attains right here the state of peace. Okay, so we can break into small group discussions, and looks like it. If we broke into four groups, it'd be mostly about six people in each group. That's kind of a nice number. And say, if we can just count off 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, 4, then maybe ones can go stay in here, twos could go over. There's a whole bunch of chairs just over by the kitchen area. Threes could go over in the breezeway, the place to sit there. Fours could go over to the monastic dining hall, the old Dhamma hall. And if you want to take chairs in there, you're welcome to. Don't leave them there. But, yeah, so if, yeah, and then we can break into group discussions, and one of the ideas that we had as a topic to, I mean, you can talk about anything, but one of the discussions could be what challenges did you have and or overcome in the meditation, and that's, you know, referring back to the thoughts and the so just to pick that up, and then return about 4 o'clock, and then we can have a group discussion, and the day will end around 4:30. So, Amy Jeannie, do you want to start? One. Yeah. Oh, okay. Three. Oh, one. Okay. So ones can be in here. Twos over by the kitchen area. The chairs are in there. Threes over in the breezeway. Fours over in the Dhamma hall. And we'll see you back here at 4 o'clock. Okay, how are we doing? Looks like we've lost a few people. Yes, absolutely. Looks like your mom is deep in discussion. Oh, really? They just come out. Okay, great. They're on their way. Very good. Yeah, we'll wait a bit. Nice to sort of go over things all together.
So many good movies that are on the pool.
You've come to the wrong place.
Not to get too off topic, but there's a Buddhist film festival in San Rafael next weekend.
And this weekend too, huh?
Next weekend, I'm not that good. Next weekend. There's actually a film from Thailand. Sorry.
thinking.
Good intention.
But it is a Buddhist.
Okay, so we've had the opportunity to have some small group discussions. I hope it was fruitful for your different groups. Maybe it might be nice to hear from the different groups of just what sticks in the mind. Just a very short summary maybe from the different groups. Maybe group one, somebody want to volunteer? Yeah?
One of the topics, questions about the two suttas that came up a couple of times was, is this meant to use during just meditation or 24/7? So that was a question.
Yeah, I definitely say 24/7 in the sense that there are techniques to deal with the mind, and your mind doesn't go away outside of meditation. So they're just helpful tools to be learning how to use and apply in daily life as well. And it can be very, very useful, very, very fruitful. Maybe group two, somebody, delegate from group two, want to...
I think one of the things that we talked about was body scanning, and
Just coming back to the body as a way to find your center. And also just generally, it seemed like everybody was conscious of skillful means and knowing themselves. We just all had different ways of knowing what works and being like adaptable and flexible to different circumstances that arise.
Right. Certainly that aspect of body scan, some aspect of a body awareness, body contemplation is a really important base, I think, for the dealing with thought. It gives enough separation or a little bit of distance and a good anchor to be able to help deal with thought skillfully. Often, just thought is so seductive in its power, and because it's immaterial, then it just, when it's out of the gates, it's gone. So it's helpful to have something that really tempers that. and that willingness to experiment with different techniques, and you'll find things that you gain confidence in, and being interested in exploring practice. I mean, when you first begin practice, then you want to be fairly prescribed in your methodology and how to lay a foundation for training. But once you've got a bit of a foundation, then it's important to take an interest in seeing, well, what works, how can I make this alive for me. So about group three, anybody from group three willing to share?
Well, we talked about the things that we do use with our thoughts and some of the pitfalls, and we're talking also about the Four Noble Truths and beginning, cessation. Talking about like some perfectionism and wanting to get a dividend with every breath.
And certainly in terms of dealing with thought or dealing with anything in practice, you can't go wrong by coming back to the Four Noble Truths, and that's really the template for bringing all the practice back to. It's like that image that Sariputta used of the elephant's footprint being all the footprints of all the animals, they'll all fit within the footprint of the elephant, in the same way that all the teachings of the Buddha will fit into this template of the Four Noble Truths. So it's a skillful way of directing attention. But somebody from group four would like to share a little bit.
So I think we're going to summarize.
We've talked so much.
Far-fetched discussion.
You can be our speaker.
It's a little hard to summarize, but we were basically talking about our suffering, suffering, and the kinds of thoughts that we're laboring under, and the nature of the obsessive thoughts and addictive type thinking, and reflecting on how these teachings might help us
to Great.
Move a little bit closer to freedom.
Excellent. Because that's a taking it from a theoretical, abstract, rational mode and bringing it back to the visceral experience. Is really important, really helpful for practice and training with, how to train with ourselves, how to train ourselves and work with the mind, work with thoughts. It's that recognition of the suffering and the suffering. How to do that? Right.
Well, what does allowing the thought to be there for a little bit? If, for example, it has real life and it means something to you and you're trying to stop it, all of a sudden you realize, oh, it's okay, this is meaningful to you, so it's fine. And then it really loses power.
Well, I think one of the ways that one uses that in the sense of having a say allowing, accepting, is to attenuate the tendency to react with ill will, or that sense of ill will, aversion, and trying to, because so much of you know where we get into trouble with that is just it goes straight to vibhava tanha, that desire to not have, not be, shouldn't be this way, and so that's a direct route to suffering. It's this sort of, so then that quality of allowing isn't just kind of a permissive allowing of any random willy-nilly thought that comes in, but it's sort of recognizing there's something there, and just to try to get rid of it is not a skillful tool. So then being able to hold it in a way that one is able to establish mindfulness and clarity so that one is paying attention to how to understand, to see it clearly, and that's an important difference. Yeah.
Maybe related, just a reflection in part from our conversation, and my own sort of experimenting, sort of the tendency to sort of, I thinking reflecting on freedom from as opposed to freedom within, meaning like sometimes there's sort of a secret hope these thoughts will just sort of go away, right? And sort of vibhava tanha.
Yeah.
As opposed to, I'm thinking of freedom within, meaning more releasing the identification with painful thoughts or difficult thoughts. And just sort of letting them come as a painful thought, letting them go, no big problem, not acting on them.
Yeah.
And I feel sometimes like this sort of, just this sort of secret hope, right? That just the hindrances will just sort of go away and die.
Yeah.
And that seems to be itself a little bit wrong view.
It sets you up for more dukkha. And one of the things that Ajahn Chah used to use, or as a tool, looking at so. Looking at thought, looking at all sorts of things, looking at experience, okay, whether it's pleasant or it's unpleasant or it's scattered or it's peaceful, and just being able to look at it and say, just that much, it's only that. And Thai, I said, it's only a little thing. So that, because we tend, like our thoughts tend to sort of turn into such big deals. That's probably because we're the ones who are thinking. it's not a big deal. and it's not, and you say, dismissive in the sense of trying to annihilate it, but it's sort of like dismissive in the sense of it's just putting it in perspective. You're not such a big deal. You're just a thought. and that's really helpful. Kristen?
Do thoughts by themselves have karmic consequences. I'm not so much thinking of the example where you have an unwholesome thought and you choose not to act on it, say to refrain from unwholesome speech, but I'm more thinking of a situation where in the mind, say in meditation, where thoughts arise, they might have all kinds of flavors or whatever, but the mind isn't moving at all to the thought.
Well, there's a whole spectrum, but certainly they have karmic consequences. And in fact, I mean, the Buddha points to the mental karma as being the strongest, as opposed to physical karma or verbal karma. And that's really interesting because it's the one to be, has the most dire consequences.
That's so discouraging.
It's certainly sobering, isn't it?
Yeah.
Mental thought.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. It's great karma.
Thank God.
Yeah.
Thank God.
Yeah.
And for me, I think it's also useful to try and distinguish a bit between what's a like an active karmic producing thought versus a sort of like a vipaka or a resultant perception and feeling that come. Have an impression and an experience and a memory that comes from past conditioning, like a really bizarre thought, we call it thought. But there's not an active karmic producing component to then what comes after it.
Yeah, because what produces karma is volition. And so that there's much that comes through the mind. Is vipaka in the sense of a resultant condition of our experience. So it's a very important distinction to make because, on a certain level, we have to know and see and learn from different aspects of our mind. But we also, we don't have to take responsibility for absolutely everything in the sense that just some of it's just random stuff. and as long as we don't take it seriously or create an identity around it, then it doesn't have any oomph to it. I think that Lupa Liam story is really... At the break, Ajahn Kurundamo shared a story that I heard that when we were all together at England last week.
Reluctant a little bit to say it in the group earlier because people might have it's a bit coarse. To people who are sensitive. But kind of hit the spot in terms of what we do sometimes with our thoughts and our proliferations. I was talking with another monk at the meetings in the hallway. We were just chatting and talking about people and problems and proliferations and... He was recounting a story of someone, a person talking with Ajahn Liam, Lumpa Liam, about their consistently bad thoughts and obsessions and trying to figure it out and reason and explain and explore and, these really kind of nasty, difficult, unskillful mind states. And kind of the analysis around that. And Lumpa Liam's comment was, if you see a pile of excrement, why would you want to go stick your nose in it?
meaning, just, you know, it's sort of like, why are you spending so much time just, you know, dwelling with this mind state and this proliferation around it? Just, you just don't go there.
The northeastern Thai Ajahns, it's both a very down-to-earth culture, but it's also the language is very down-to-earth as well. Bambor. It's like it can be a lot more direct in the northeastern dialect than you can even in the Thai language. And they're most, all of the great Ajahns are mostly northeasterners.
And the great women. And the great women.
I was going to say, I think my problem is my nose is already in there, and I don't want to realize it's so stupid that it's already in there. That ego death is kind of more painful.
Yeah, sometimes I was just getting some perspective around it. Okay.
Yeah. That story about Lampa Lian reminded me of another story I heard about her that I heard from Ajahn Yanako on a recorded talk that when Lampa Lian was here, he learned that Ukiah is like there's a Thai, correct me if I'm wrong, but there's in Thai like Ukiah like means the garbage.
Oh, Ukiah. Ukiah. Ukiah.
I guess there were a lot of Toms around when he realized that. And so whenever some of the monks were like giving him foot massage and he was giving Dhamma gems to them, one of the things he was saying, he said it in Thai, I can't reproduce that, but he was basically saying, like, don't let your mind, don't live in the garbage.
It's just so, you know, there's the contents of the mind. It's just so hard to not identify with them, to not make it me and mine. And all.
Yeah.
It just feels like this is me and mine. It is, you know, my practice slowly chipping away at that assumption or connection or whatever. But there it is, and that's where my feelings of sort of humiliation or whatever around, my God, that's what I'm thinking right now. I mean, they were a lot stronger in the early days, not just, you know, like intense pain about the things that my mind would kick up. But it's part of what helps to unplug is that realizing how useless so many of them are.
Yeah.
Like they've never, these roiling or obsessive thoughts that are trying to figure out the biggest questions of life, that it's just so ill-equipped.
Right.
To really come up with the answers and and then just leading me so many times down the garden path. And
And a lot of it is just remembering that. You know, so much of that's actually the word that that's been translated as mindfulness, in Pali, sati, its roots are in memory. So recollection is not a bad translation at all. And so that bringing mindfulness, recollecting, so that remembering, because, and it's not that we can't be aware, it's just we keep forgetting, or that we don't know and understand, we forgetting. So then it's that using that mindfulness to keep remembering. Okay, this is what needs to do. This is actually the reality of things. This is really the truth of things. It's not that's kind of the self agenda or the sort of identity that we we crank out all the time.
Something you just said, this really clicked with me too, where you use the word, you know, when you're seeing all these, you know, unskillful mind states, but you used to have a sense of humiliation around it.
Mm-hmm.
And to me it's sort of like, yeah, the transition when you start to see it is not self.
Mm-hmm.
Takes away the humiliation, but there's still humility.
Okay, yeah. Last question. Last comment. Yeah.
Is there a reason why mindfulness is number 7 in the path?
Because the Buddha put it there. I don't know.
It just seems like it's a thread through everything.
Well, that's actually where you, like, if you go to the great four, in the Majjhima Nikaya, the great 40, I think it's one Majjhima 115. 117. And that's a really interesting sutta, because then it's it's talking about the path, but then it talks about how different aspects of the path keep circling as these. Okay. One makes an effort to abandon wrong view and to enter upon right view. This is one's right effort. Mindfully one abandons wrong view, mindfully one enters upon and abides in right view. This is one's right mindfulness. Thus these three states run and circle around right view. That is, right view, right effort, and right mindfulness. These, and then he goes through the path with that, the whole Eightfold Path. Lovely sutta.
Can I just ask, is this recorded, all of this?
Yes. Yes. Yeah. It's be on YouTube. Yeah, it'll be on our YouTube channel. Yeah. So it's, I think it was broadcast. We were web streaming. And then it'll go up on our YouTube channel. Be there. Be there forever. Okay, let's end today's session with a dedication of merit. If people want to maybe get the chanting books, I think it's page 18 or 19. Oh, anyway, I can't remember. But anyway, we'll take a... I think I've got... It's the verses of sharing and aspiration. Verses of sharing and... 33. Page 33. We can do, yeah. Let's chant the verses of sharing and aspiration through the goodness that arises from my practice. May my spiritual teachers and guides of great virtue, my mother, my father, and my relatives, the sun and the moon, and all virtuous leaders of the world, may the highest gods and evil forces, celestial beings, guardian spirits of the earth, and the Lord of Death, may those who are friendly, indifferent, or hostile, may all beings receive the blessings of my life. May they soon attain the threefold bliss and realize the deathless through the goodness that arises from my practice. And through this act of sharing, may all desires and attachments quickly cease, and all harmful states of mind, until I realize Nibbana in every kind of birth. May I have an upright mind with mindfulness and wisdom, austerity and vigor. May the forces of delusion not take hold, nor weaken my resolve. The Buddha is my excellent refuge. Unsurpassed is the protection of the Dhamma. The solitary Buddha is my noble guide. The Sangha is my supreme support. Through the supreme power of all these, may darkness and delusion be dispelled. Okay. Delightful day.